With a special stay-bow yoke, he snapped it onto two rings, one at each shoulder, and away he flew. It was ingenious. Not only did the stay-bow rig hold its rider securely, but it left his hands free to use weapons. Another tactical subject given much thought was countering enemy attempts to hit teams at night, for the NVA realized teams seldom had radio contact with anyone after dark. Therefore, like a rabbit taking cover in a briar patch, at dusk, a recon team squirmed into the thickest, thorniest foliage it could find, preferably on the side of a hill, to make enemy night sweeps difficult to control. Team members lay so close in a rest overnight, RON position, that each man touched a man on either side, a whole team in a space so small the NVA couldn't imagine they could be there, which was the idea. The NVA would have to step on them to find them. Your rucksack was your pillow, and you slept in your web gear, just opening the belt and propping it behind you so it naturally fell back into place when you sat up. Your weapon was never beyond your grasp. Before dark, the 10 squatted beside each man and pointed from one tree to another to designate his share of the perimeter, describing where to throw grenades and where to emplace his claymore mine. Because of backblast danger, the U.S. Army warns against positioning claymores closer than 50 feet, even for entrenched soldiers. SOG claymores were but 15 feet away on the opposite side of trees, so backblast would be absorbed. Why so close? A distant claymore might be found by NVA searchers who'd follow it back to the team or turn it toward the team without discovery. When a team was hit in the RON, likely it was because trackers had followed them, then fetched special counter-recon troops who operated confidently in darkness. Typically it began with one or two NVA letting loose with AKs in hopes the recon men would shoot back or blow a claymore, pinpointing their position. I can close my eyes and still see a night in Laos with Medal of Honor recipient Franklin Miller, Glenn Uemura, and Chuck Hine. A counter-recon unit came after us. Without the slightest warning, an AK not 40 feet away suddenly ripped the air. Illuminated by his 3-foot muzzle frame, I watched the NVA turn his head round and round, watching for our tiniest reaction. All that kept me from squeezing the last ounce from my Kar-15 trigger, aimed squarely at his head, was the certainty that hidden nearby were dozens of NVA ready to pounce. His commander offered this poor sap's life, but we weren't takers. It was a long, hard night. Relaxing at night might mean death. Better to stay uneasy, alert, easily terrified, with the tiniest sound jolting you awake, your heart pounding. It might be a passing tiger, but it might be an NVA counter-recon platoon crawling up on you. By dawn you were packed and ready to go, sitting in an outward-looking circle, quietly eating rice, watching your claymores, and waiting for Covey's morning radio check. After that you recovered your claymores and were on your way. If you were hit in daytime, you'd dash about 200 yards, then shift into evasive movement to shake off pursuers. You traded speed for minimizing what trackers call sign. If you moved quickly, you might gain distance, but you left a detectable trail. Evasion often was preferable to a foot race, because the enemy carried less gear and could outpace you on parallel trails or relay word ahead via radio and telephone. Stopping was hazardous. A 30-second head start might become a clean escape, while just 10 seconds wasted could mean encirclement and annihilation. In a hot target, an additional 40-man platoon of NVA joined the search every 10 minutes after contact, even more troops when there was a major trail or road nearby. Sometimes teams abandoned rucksacks to gain speed, like a lizard giving up its tail to a closing predator. Once unburdened, it seemed a team could fly through the jungle, while the enemy couldn't help but pause to examine his windfall. This could prove his undoing. With pursuers gaining on him, Bob Howard once tore off his shirt, threw it across a bush, and left a few toe poppers in front of it. Sure enough, 3 minutes later he heard 2 toe poppers go off, and that ended the pursuit. When you had wounded men and couldn't move fast or far, then you grabbed defensive terrain, such as a hilltop or bomb crater, stacked reload magazines, and fought it out. You hoped you were beside an LZ so you could exfil as quick as TAC air reduced or pushed back the enemy. But you had to get out soon, or the NVA would rush in a 100-man company and 12.7mm machine guns. If your fight lasted overnight, by dawn they'd have trucked down 37mm anti-aircraft guns and hordes of ground troops. The NVA tried to get so close that airstrikes would endanger the team as much as them, but being a fatalistic lot, SOGmen called in TAC air anyhow, sometimes right across themselves, chancing accidental death from the air rather than certain death from the NVA. In conventional units, medals were given to those who'd call in airstrikes on themselves. In SOG, it was an ordinary affair. Desperation inspired risks that the NVA would not match. Ken Shoebox Carpenter's team once found itself hotly pursued by NVA that kept pushing them toward a cliff, where at last they seemed pinned. Then Kenny and his yards held hands and jumped into the treetops 30 feet below, crashing through foliage, bouncing violently between branches and spraining a few ankles, but by God, they all hit the ground alive. Not a single NVA had the inclination to follow them. After 5 days facing such dangers deep behind enemy lines, meticulous in every act, deliberate in every step, seldom even whispering, hunted day and night like an animal by hundreds, sometimes thousands of enemy, a SOG man's mental focus wore down, fuzzing the keen edge so crucial to his survival. He had to come out. And then he needed a 1 week stand down to unwind and recharge before running that deadly gauntlet again. During stand down, recon men did as they wished, when they wished. They'd lounge around the NCO club in cut off blue jeans and tennis shoes. Harvey Saul once arrived in such filthy fatigues that the Boo-Fi club manager announced, "I will not serve you in the club dressed like that." Fair enough. Saul went outside, stripped and returned buck naked, demanding service. And he got it. If an entertaining poker game was underway and it was closing time, they'd extend the club hours, a practice that so exasperated the Da Nang club manager that one night he tossed a tear gas grenade under a card table. 5 minutes later, the whole group was back, playing poker in gas masks. I remember one afternoon joining a conga line of recon men, drunk, sober, and in between, that spontaneously formed up, snaked its way around the compound and into the club, chanting, "Cha-cha recon, cha-cha recon." It was crazy. But that craziness was not restricted to SOG's remote bases. On stand down, recon men could travel anywhere in South Vietnam and stay at SOG safe houses in Da Nang and Saigon, or at the 5th Special Forces headquarters in Nha Trang. The evening might begin in a genteel enough way with lobster and French onion soup at the Hotel Nautique, but deterioration via alcohol and debauchery inevitably followed. Recon men lived like there was no tomorrow because often there wasn't. Yet they kept a sense of humor. The best running gag concerned the hilariously obnoxious Walter Shoemate, a superb SOG and Project Delta trooper. It began inauspiciously when a Green Beret gave candy to a Vietnamese girl and told her, "Here you are, my dear. My name is Walter Shoemate." Not much, but the snowball had begun rolling. Word spread to attribute everything and anything to Walter. A guy would win a bet, and while scooping up his winnings, he'd boast, "You should have known better than to bet against Walter Shoemate." Or after beating the crap out of some Marine, the victorious pugilist would holler from the bar doorway, "If any of you bastards wants a piece of me, my name is Walter Shoemate." Tales of Shoemate's dares, threats, boasts, and fame, infamy, spread across South Vietnam, perhaps the world. His became the name most often entered in seedy hotel registers, exceeding even those standbys A. Lincoln and G. Washington, with no two signatures even faintly similar. What robust staying power this Shoemate possessed, for he signed out more Taipei prostitutes than any 10 men. What a specimen. And when word of some new misadventure filtered back, the real Walter would declare, for instance, "I have never been to Hong Kong in my life." But the truth was that he basked in the notoriety. First Sergeant Billy Greenwood understood the antics. When you're out there face to face with a man, and either you kill him or he kills you, it's pretty tough. There's no such thing as getting acclimated to it. And when a man comes back to a secure area, he does strange things. It's like a pressure cooker. There's got to be a little valve to let this pressure off, and that was our means of letting it off. When a recon man did too much screwing around on stand down, and too many SOG's superiors had to cover for his antics, he was told to get back into the field and earn his redemption. And the best redemption from the worst trouble was to capture a prisoner, or, as SOG troopers said, to pull off a snatch. 9. The Snatchers. The SOG mission that most demanded ingenuity and audacity was snatching enemy prisoners. By hook and crook, by trickery and device, by technology and technique, SOG men aspired to perfect their kidnapping craft, developing more skill in this artful science than at any time in previous military history. Rewards and accolades were heaped upon successful snatchers, and with good reason. There is no intelligence source so fruitful as a freshly snatched prisoner. Taking a prisoner meant a free R&R to Taiwan aboard a SOG Blackbird on maintenance rotation, a $100 bonus for each American, and a new Seiko wristwatch and cash to each Hnong or Montagnard. Despite the incentives during the entire war, SOG teams snatched fewer than 50 prisoners from Laos and Cambodia. Hunting was good in the early days. In 1966, SOG's first full year of Laotian operations, recon teams seized 12 prisoners. It remained fair in 1967, with 10 NVA snatched, but new enemy counter-recon units and expanded security forces proved their worth by 1968, when seizures tumbled to one, and in 1969, not a single NVA prisoner was brought out of Laos. SOG teams snatched just 18 prisoners from Cambodia between 1967 and 1970. A snatch meant initiating contact in dangerous areas against forces that usually outnumbered your team. And when you grabbed someone, the prisoner slowed your pace while other NVA chased all the harder, knowing you had one of their own. Snatch tactics were a subject of endless NCO club debate, but it essentially came down to three options: disabling the candidate with a carefully placed gunshot, knocking him senseless with explosives, or just plain grabbing him. A gunshot was tricky because it was difficult to incapacitate but not kill your target. For this reason, many teams preferred SOG's least powerful suppressed weapon, the 22 caliber high standard model HD pistol. In early 1969, Master Sergeant Norm Doney, 10 of RT Florida, took careful aim with a 22 high standard at an NVA approaching him on a side road near Laotian Highway 110. Minutes earlier, Doney had positioned a three-man Hnong security team in a curve 50 yards down the road, telling them to block any reaction force so he could disable and capture a passing NVA. RT Florida's only other American, Sergeant Joe Morris, stood by at a rally point 100 yards in the jungle, in radio contact with Covey. SOG helicopters were nearby, inserting another team just minutes away. Conditions seemed ideal. Soon, a nice, husky NVA appeared. Doney let him approach to 10 feet and then plugged him in the thigh. He collapsed, dropping his AK. Perfect. But unknown to the 10, around that curve a long line of NVA troops followed, visible to Doney's security men, who, instead of shooting to buy their leader time, turned and ran so noisily that the NVA column opened fire. Doney, his interpreter, and an Arvin sergeant were standing over the wounded NVA when their teammates rushed past, running for their lives. The Arvin sergeant and interpreter ran away too. Then an exploding RPG rocket knocked Donnie to his knees, peppering him with shrapnel. The would-be prisoner leaped for his AK, but Donnie groggily managed to shoot first, popping him several times with the suppressed pistol, killing him. With NVA advancing up the road, Donnie rejoined Joe Morris and ran to an LZ, where they found the rest of their team. While awaiting extraction, they heard a truckload of troops drive up. An airstrike destroyed it. Then Huey swooped in and pulled them out. Yet they'd been so close. After chewing asses all around, Donnie decided to repeat the ambush, and what better spot than that very curve? Exactly 1 month later, RT Florida crept up to the same spot, this time with a third American, Sergeant Bill Stubbs. But an NVA happened along and spotted Stubbs, who drilled him. With the cat out of the bag, they had to run for it again. A few weeks later, another recon team passed the curve and found the enemy had posted a sign warning, "Danger Zone Ahead." And sure enough, the team noted, whenever enemy troops passed Donnie's ambush site, they'd fire a few magazines into the bushes like kids whistling past a graveyard on a spooky night. It made RT Florida proud, but not as proud as had they snatched a man. Of SOG's various suppressed weapons, the .380 Walther PPK automatic pistol with psionics suppressor was popular. Compact and extremely quiet, it fired standard .380 ammo loaded for subsonic velocities, which eliminated the bullet's crack in flight. So quiet, 10 Newman Ruff recalls, that the first time I went out and played with it, I kept hearing these funny noises, and finally, rather than look at the target, I watched the gun when I fired it, and the funny noise was the shell cases hitting the ground. But most of SOG's suppressed weapons weren't pistols but submachine guns, used to eliminate trackers and sentries, and occasionally to attempt snatches. I carried a suppressed 9mm Swedish K submachine gun when I went into northeast Cambodia with RT Illinois to assess one of Henry Kissinger's so-called secret B-52 raids, in hopes that if we came upon a small party of bomb-disoriented NVA, I could dispatch all but one, and we'd take him prisoner. Instead, we bumped head-on into an NVA unit, exchanged fire, and had two of our indigs hit bad. Ben Thompson, our 10, dragged them toward an LZ, while my other U.S. teammate, George Bacon, and I delayed the enemy. When George fired his Car 15, enemy soldiers ducked and dove. When I fired my silenced Swedish K, it had virtually no effect. They didn't know I was shooting. But that wasn't all. When finally we rejoined the team, a lone NVA suddenly popped up and almost got me. But I dealt him a solid torso burst and he went down. When a Huey landed to evac our wounded, I rushed past where the NVA had fallen and saw that he crawled away with his AK. It may have worked well for snatches, but the suppressed Swedish K lacked a lethal punch for ordinary firefights. But another SOG submachine gun had great lethality, despite its suppressor. The .45 caliber M3 grease gun retained deadly terminal ballistics because its hefty 230-grain slugs weighed twice as much as 9mm cartridges. An OSS product, the M3's muffled muzzle generated sound only a few decibels above that caused by the firing mechanism alone. It was heavy, over 11 pounds, yet some SOG men preferred it because the M3 held steady with almost no muzzle rise. One of SOG's legendary 10s, Jerry Mad Dog Shriver, often carried a suppressed grease gun. An acquaintance of Shriver's, RT Hammer 10, Jim McKay, brought a suppressed grease gun along for a prisoner snatch in the Fishhook region of Cambodia. Just 3 hours after insert, McKay, his 1-1 Brian Stockdale, an American accompanying them, and 4 yards came to a series of high-speed trails. Cargo-laden bicycles rolled past, and loud voices called out from several directions. They found a bundle of communications wires 2 inches thick. "We knew there was something pretty major around," Stockdale recalled. 10 McKay figured they'd better attempt to snatch immediately and get away fast. While Stockdale radioed a nearby FAC, McKay arrayed the team along a trail and cocked his grease gun. They'd take the next man coming down the trail. The FAC radioed the Saglanch site at Budap, 50 miles away. USAF Green Hornet helicopters headed for the fishhook. R.T. Hammer hadn't lain there 5 minutes when along came a lone enemy soldier, his AK slung because his hands were full of canteens. When he was just 10 feet away, McKay took aim at his leg, squeezed the greased gun trigger, but the bolt lurched to the magazine lip and jammed there, making a loud thunk. The startled NVA dropped his canteens, but just as quickly, two R.T. Hammer yards pounced on him and, with Stockdale, dragged him into the bushes, handcuffed and blindfolded him. McKay came over to help and set down his errant grease gun, and the bolt snapped forward and popped one shot into Stockdale's leg, under the knee. Stockdale felt the pain, thought he'd been hit by some distant gunman, then he noticed smoke wisping from the M3's suppressor. He soundly cursed out his 1-0. However, he found just a grazing wound. He could walk, and fortunately no one had heard the shot. Soon the Green Hornets were overhead, and R.T. Hammer escaped without a hitch. Two of Sog's other suppressed snatch guns were British in origin, developed by England's World War II Special Operations Executive, SOE, which ran agents, resistance groups, and saboteurs into Nazi-occupied Europe. One was the Wellrod pistol, the first ever purpose-designed suppressed handgun. Indeed, the Wellrod was just a 143/8-inch tube, the front half of a suppressor and the back half its rotary bolt action. The grip was simply a rubber-wrapped Colt 32 auto magazine. Since each round was chambered manually, the Wellrod generated absolutely no sound from slide movement or escaping gas. It was so quiet that a World War II agent could sit behind his quarry in a darkened theater, fire a shot, and walk away without anyone the wiser. The USS found it most effective when used with the muzzle against the target. While Sogman thought it impressively quiet, it was not accurate beyond about 10 paces, which, combined with its low rate of fire, made it more suited to assassinations than prisoner snatches. Nevertheless, some teams employed well rods. Sog's other British firearm was the suppressed Sten Mark IIs submachine gun, with its distinctive side-mounted magazine. The Sten had practical appeal for snatching. It disassembled into three components you packed in your rucksack, so your primary armament was a more powerful Kar-15 or AK-47, and you broke out the Sten only at the ambush site. But reflecting its economical manufacture, the Sten lacked accuracy. Sten often accompanied SOG teams into Laos and Cambodia, and it was an attempt to snatch in Laos that saw perhaps the most tasteless employment of a suppressed Sten in SOG history. Those involved shall remain nameless. This team was sent in to surveil a river, beside which they found a large trail, so the team leader decided to kill two birds. He laid out a snatch ambush at a spot from which he could surveil the river too. After a few hours, 6 NVA crossed the river and walked right into his ambush. But by now it was clear many other NVA were nearby. 1-0 dared not start a firefight. But the NVA squad stopped right there, dumped rucksacks and 5 of them stripped to their skivvies, then jumped in the water. 1 NVA remained behind to guard their equipment and AKs, hardly a dozen feet from the 1-0. It began to drizzle and the NVA guard donned a plastic poncho. The recon men heard more NVA voices. Sooner or later they'd be spotted. They had to quietly eliminate this lone NVA guard and sneak off. The 1-0 put his stand sight on the NVA's head, but then he noticed a peculiar expression on the man's face and a bouncing movement beneath his plastic poncho. The man was masturbating. Out of some peculiar sense of decency, the 1-0 held his fire but trained his Sten on the soldier's head until the man was finished. Then 1-0 fired 2 silent shots, and the guard slumped forward, forever euphoric. In 10 seconds the SOG team was gone, having created one of SOG's truly great campfire stories. Sometimes just plain aggressiveness yielded prisoners. Captain Ed Lassane, Khantoum's recon company commander in 1968, emphasized snatches but found a real reluctance among the teams to assume the extra risks, so he accompanied a team into Laos to snatch an NVA himself. A few hands predicted failure, noting Lassane's teammates were reservists from the Florida-based 20th Special Forces Group. But Lassane and the reservists performed like seasoned pros, creeping up on a major enemy supply dump secured by 100 NVA. For 3 days they lay beside a trail, watching passers-by, until they found an NVA who went back and forth several times a day. Lassane sent the others to secure the escape route to a nearby LZ, keeping just one American with him for security. Like clockwork, here came the lone NVA. The recon commander raised his unsuppressed M16. "I shot him in the leg," Lassane recalled, jumped on him and stuck a morphine injection in him, gagged him and tied his hands with plastic restraints. Lassane's teammate, Sergeant First Class George Hunt, gunned down 3 NVA drawn by the shot, then a machine gun opened fire from a bunker only 30 yards away, forcing them behind a termite mound. The Green Beret captain chucked one grenade to throw the crew off balance so he could take time to deliberately hurl a second one. It rolled right into their bunker, silencing the gun. Then Lassane and Hunt rejoined the team and 15 minutes later flew away with SOG's first Laotian prisoner in 9 months. SOG's search for the perfect snatch weapon was a never-ending quest. Chief SOG Colonel Jack Singlob had great interest in tranquilizing darts. Like you would shoot at a tiger if you wanted to brush its teeth or something. But he found himself butting heads with Pentagon officers who voiced technical objections that masked an aversion for anything remotely connected with chemical warfare. Singlob raised the tranquilizer issue in a mid-1968 meeting with the 4 service chiefs in the Pentagon's Joint Chiefs Conference Room. They asked about NVA reaction to SOG helicopter insertion of recon teams, and they wanted my opinion on the ability of SOG teams to capture valuable NVA officers on the trail. I pointed out the Pentagon's refusal to authorize tranquilizer darts for this very purpose. Army Chief of Staff Westmoreland made it clear the matter would be reconsidered. It was. Several SOG teams subsequently tested tranquilizer guns, but learned the same thing that veterinarians did when anesthetizing dangerous animals. By the time dosage is sufficient to incapacitate quickly, it's enough to kill, while safe dosages act so slowly that the subject remains a threat to anyone within reach. The SOG men were compelled to gun down the NVA hit by darts or watch helplessly as they died from the anesthetic. When tranquilizer darts failed, SOG tested another chemical incapacitator, mace, the non-lethal spray used by police. But a few recon men had been maced during stateside barroom brawls and warned it was not always effective. Some snatches were accomplished the old-fashioned way. Down in Cambodia's fishhook, R.T. Pick 10 Everett Kofor and 12 David Zack planned to cover while 11 Bob Graham seized a passing NVA. It was a dangerous place, with the jungle so heavily occupied that they watched an NVA unit stack arms for morning exercises. "We were being super quiet," Graham said. 10 Kofor selected a spot on a trail between 2 battalion base camps, meaning 1,000 NVA were within a half mile. Hardly had they set up when flank security signaled the man was coming. There wasn't time for anything fancy. Graham jumped out and punched the soldier right between the eyes. He collapsed. 3 recon men leaped on him and covered his mouth while the team interpreter whispered, "Your silence or your life." The soldier opted for life. It turned out he was a kidnapped South Vietnamese pressed into enemy service and so happy to be free that he dredged up every scrap of information he could recall. "It was a good catch," Graham said. Not quite so lucky was another team leader, I shall not identify beyond his code name, Fat Cat, who planned to step out on a trail and grab a lone passing NVA. When Fat Cat stepped out, he found 2 NVA and instantly had to shoot one in order to subdue the other. It seemed a success, with Fat Cat's team outrunning NVA pursuers, reaching an LZ and being extracted. The truth came during interrogation. After responding negatively to a litany of questions, the exasperated NVA private finally protested, "Why do you keep asking me things I don't know? You should have asked the colonel." The interrogator blinked. "What colonel?" "Why, the one your commando killed on the trail." Alas, Fat Cat would be known as the man who shot a colonel to capture a private. Far more frequently employed than fisticuffs were explosives laid out as a demolition ambush. In theory, the blast would knock the target off his feet, wrench his AK from his hands, and render him temporarily senseless. But the unpredictability of blast effects always left demo ambushes a sort of grab bag. You never knew what you'd find after the smoke cleared. Captain Ned Lassane accompanied a snatch mission in which the demo went off exactly as the 1-0 had planned, knocking 5 NVA off their feet, and all were dead. SOG's most sophisticated demo ambushes employed Astrolite, a unique liquid explosive whose existence was not publicly known at the time. A byproduct of NASA rocket fuel research, Astrolite had the remarkable property of detonating anything you soaked with it, such as the dirt on a trail, and came in 2 plastic bottles you combined on the spot. Once you mixed it together, the stuff was so damned unstable that you had to either use it right away or get rid of it, explained Captain Bill O'Rourke, a SOG Hatchet Force commander who used Astrolite in Cambodia. "We created a thing we called a gate by pouring this liquid down both sides of the trail, making a rectangular box with a space in there for our target," O'Rourke said. "Once the individual we wanted was in that space, boom." After snatching a party of 3 NVA this way, O'Rourke's men were rewarded with a week in Taiwan. The NVA had a reputation for fanatical resistance, but it was seldom that NVA prisoners turned out to be fanatics. A hot meal, shower, and fresh clothes typically opened an intelligence spigot. Take the case of a prisoner brought back from Cambodia by Jerry Mad Dog Shriver. When CCS Intelligence NCO Dale Libby asked the prisoner his job, the little man thrust out his chest and boasted, "I'm a killer." "Well, who do you kill?" Libby inquired. "I kill Americans," the prisoner growled. The interrogation continued. "How many Americans have you killed?" The little man's thin shoulders sagged. "Well, none yet." Libby stopped the interview, took him to the mess hall, got him a plate piled with food, which he wolfed down, then took him over for a shower. You could see his eyes change. He got fed. He got clothed. Nobody beat him. Later, the prisoner admitted his whole adult life had been one catastrophe after another. Kidnapped by the communists, wounded in a B-52 strike, underfed in Cambodia, beaten for minor infractions, bedridden with malaria, then captured by his enemies. The SOG men nicknamed him Charlie Brown. When his interrogation ended several days later, and he was turned over to the military police for transport to a POW camp, Libby watched them drive away. "And Charlie Brown looked back like a puppy leaving home," Libby said. But there was another kind of NVA, the hard court of the death type. A CCN recon team snatched such a man west of the DMZ along an enemy fuel pipeline running out of North Vietnam. Making it safely to an LZ, they asked the prisoner, a sergeant, how many NVA were in the area. 1 million, he snapped. According to Captain Jim Storter, they'd caught the baddest son of a bitch in the NVA army, their Sergeant Rock. Like a chained animal, he struggled against his plastic wrist restraints. American Hueys dropped the Team McGuire rigs, but they had 9 men and only 8 rigs, so they looped the prisoner's plastic restraint through a wrist loop and sat him down on the burly 1-1's lap, facing him. Off they went. They gradually climbed to 2,000 feet and 10 minutes later could make out the Khe San airstrip in the distance. But sight of the American base panicked the NVA prisoner, who began struggling like a man possessed, ramming his head into the 1-1, kicking and pushing them away from the others. Swinging pendulum-like beneath the Huey, the 1-0 sailed past his struggling assistant and smacked the prisoner, But that agitated him all the more, and astoundingly, he snapped the plastic restraint as the 1-1 seized him in a headlock. Then the prisoner twisted away and bit the 1-1's arm. The American pushed the NVA's head back, which started him sliding off the 1-1's lap. The NVA began nipping like a mad dog and trying to pull grenades off the 1-1's web gear. All that was holding the wriggling NVA was the 1-1. Then the prisoner bit into the muscular Green Beret's neck, and that was the last straw. Despite the team leader's shouts, the 1-1 held the NVA's head with both hands, jerked him away from his bleeding neck, shouted, "Fuck you," and let him go. It would make for a nice sentiment to say how deeply impressed they were by the NVA's suicidal devotion, but the truth is the 1-0's greatest regret when he saw the NVA crash through the treetops was losing out on a free trip to Taiwan. On his fourth try to snatch a prisoner in Cambodia, 1-0 Mike Cooper, not his real name, laid a hasty ambush along a trail just as a bicycle happened along. His nungs inadvertently shot the bicyclist. A quick search of the body yielded nothing of value, so Cooper took a closer look at the bicycle. He'd never known anyone to bring back a bicycle, so grabbing the handlebars, he wheeled it into the jungle. Cooper encrypted his situation report into 3-letter groups, but without bothering to encrypt bicycle, and transmitted it to a FAQ, who relayed it to Ban Mei Thot, where a radio operator decrypted it. Cooper's message described the contact and reported one enemy KIA, but the message's last two groups puzzled the radio operator. It seemed to say, "have captured," followed by the unencrypted word, "bicycle." Captured a bicycle? No way. The radio man scanned his daily code word list, but bicycle wasn't there. Maybe Cooper had mistakenly used the previous day's code word. When he checked it, the radio man's jaw dropped. Bicycle meant general. Cooper had captured an NVA general. The radio operator called the FAQ on secure voice scrambler and said, "Have Cooper confirm he has a bicycle. He has a North Vietnamese general." The Air Force pilot raised Cooper and requested, "Confirm you have a North Vietnamese bicycle. Repeat, home plate needs confirmation. You have a North Vietnamese bicycle." Reclining against an old termite mound, his feet propped against the two-wheeler, Cooper lit a cigarette and looked for a manufacturer's seal on the frame, but heavy paint obscured the inscription. "I think it's North Vietnamese," he radioed, "but it might be Chinese. Can't tell for sure." Even as the radio operator got confirmation, the CCS commander rushed in, the rumor already having rocked his office. "Is it true? Cooper actually has a general?" Just to be absolutely sure, the radio operator contacted the FAQ yet again. "Home plate wants to confirm. I repeat, confirm. Team has a bicycle, and it's intact. Over." The inane questions were starting to irritate Cooper. The seat was worn a bit, and maybe it was missing a spoke or two, but it was certainly usable. "Listen," he snapped, "the bicycle's fine now, but if you don't come get us pretty quick, I'll put a couple of bullets through it and dump it here." The FAQ switched to secure voice, barely containing himself. "Team leader confirms. He has an unwounded general officer and he wants out ASAP or he'll shoot him himself." That was enough for the CCS commander, who ordered, "Give me the direct line to Saigon." In 2 minutes, Chief Sog was in the know. He flash-messaged MACV headquarters. What a catch! This would be Sog's greatest triumph. Had there been time, 1,000 men and 100 helicopters would have gone after the general, but by now the enemy would be massing too, to retrieve him. This was no time to tarry. The CCS commander would lead the pickup personally. Not an hour later, a formation of Green Hornets circled in wide orbit over Cooper, who was instructed, "First aircraft in is for the bicycle, only the bicycle." Gunships whisked past at low level, trying to draw fire. Then came a Huey that hovered a foot off the ground. Beckoning arms waved from the Huey, and Cooper left the woodline, wheeling the bicycle. And all the while his commander kept looking beyond Cooper, Right, left, everywhere but at the two-wheeler. The lieutenant colonel shouted, "Where's the bicycle?" Cooper set it on the skid and beamed, "Right here." "No, damn it," the lieutenant colonel repeated. "I mean the bicycle." But as he grasped the handlebars, his eyes widened, and the horror sank in. As the Huey lifted away, the officer must have wanted to throw that bicycle at Cooper. But the bicycle made it safely back to the SOG compound at Ban Mae Tot, where for the rest of his tour, Cooper rode it in grudging defiance of a torrent of guffaws. At higher levels, there was enough embarrassment to go around, so nobody pointed a finger at anyone else. Even a failed snatch attempt could have combat effect. Probably the most successful ambush of the war resulted from a failed SOG prisoner snatch. Staff Sergeant Ralph Rod's RT Colorado had lain beside a Laotian trail a half day when they heard approaching enemy, but they soon realized there were far too many NVA to attempt a snatch. Rod counted almost 300 men. Then a whistle blew and they stopped, formed ranks right in front of RT Colorado's 8 claymores, stacked arms, and opened their rucksacks for lunch. Just 5 yards away, the RT Colorado men dared not even breathe. Then an NVA soldier stepped off the trail, undid his fly to urinate, and saw a Montagnard. Instantly, Rod's men detonated all 8 claymores, emptied their Kar-15s, tossed grenades, and ran with such abandon that the 6 of them were plucked away from 6 different LZs. Not a one was wounded. We can only imagine the horrendous NVA casualties, for they did not return Rod's fire for 5 full minutes. Though SOG attempted numerous snatches, rarely did SOG teams target a particular person. One such mission began in early 1970 in the conference room of General Creighton Abrams, then commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam. The 7th Air Force commander, General George Brown, and Abrams' senior intelligence officer, Major General Philip Davidson, were discussing USAF reports of heavy night truck traffic in southern Laos. It was perplexing. How were these convoys reaching South Vietnam? What was their cargo and where was it going? Without precise answers, American B-52 strikes were little more than darts tossed at a map. General Abrams turned to Colonel Steve Cavanaugh. Was there something SOG could do? Chief SOG Cavanaugh promised Abrams he'd look into it. Back at SOG headquarters, Cavanaugh's staff suggested sweeping southeast Laos with recon teams, but the area was so full of NVA that half the teams would be discovered. No, what Chief SOG wanted was something more precise, tailored, a single operation with enough priority and support to get the job done. It hit him like a flash. "You know," Cavanaugh announced, "one of the big things we could do is grab somebody from a truck." It was brilliant. A convoy driver had to know the location of truck parks, supply dumps, major headquarters, his cargo, every bit of information 7th Air Force and MACV wanted. Yet Cavanaugh realized the odds were terrible, with enemy security so vast and ubiquitous that not a single prisoner had come out of Laos in all of 1969. Though he voiced optimism before his subordinates, privately Cavanaugh believed, "In my wildest imagination, I never thought that we would succeed." Cavanaugh met with the FOB 2 commander, Lieutenant Colonel Frederick T. Abt, charging him with selecting his best men to ambush a North Vietnamese convoy and seize a truck driver. A mission that required a hell of a lot of experience and skill, Chief SOG added. Abt had permission from the U.S. ambassador to Laos to send in 10 Americans, triple the normal complement. To lead what became Operation Ashtray, Abt appointed Major Frank Jacks, his most experienced officer. Already well into his 3rd year in Vietnam, Jacks had led SOG's first Bright Light POW rescue mission in 1966. Picking from among FOB 2's top 5 recon teams, Major Jacks accepted 8 volunteers, Oliver Hartwig, Daniel Sturr, Ray Harris, John Blaw, Tim Lynch, Forrest Todd, Bill Spurgeon, and John Grant. They trained at SOG's Naval Advisory Detachment SEAL Base in Da Nang, for their first challenge was determining how to halt a truck without killing the driver. There was nothing in our manuals, nothing anywhere, Jack said. John Grant, the team demo man, tested various explosive charges before deciding upon 5 claymores in a series, arrayed in a crescent to focus their blast and collapse a truck's front wheels. After 7 days of planning and rehearsals, the Operation Ashtray men inserted into southern Laos. On the third night, they lay beside Highway 110 and watched 4 convoys, each with more than 20 trucks, roll by. The next night split into 2 elements, one led by Jax, the other by Oliver Hartwig. They were ready to snatch a driver. Hartwig's element struck first, ambushing the last truck in a 17-vehicle convoy, but the combined mine blast and team small arms fire killed the driver. Meanwhile, Jack's element hit another truck. Dan Sturr went after the driver, but a second truck rolled up, loaded with NVA firing over the cab. The SOG men silenced the NVA guards, but not a single NVA was left alive to capture. There were no friendly casualties. Early the next morning, they were lifted away amid only light ground fire. Although no prisoner was seized, Jack's men had destroyed 3 trucks and killed or wounded about a dozen NVA. The first snatch was damned near successful, Colonel Kavanaugh concluded. It could have gone. After briefing General Abrams, Chief SOG decided it was worth a second try. That night in the NCO club, fresh back from stateside leave, I listened to the Operation Ashtray men recount their ambush. Several 10s, including myself and Willie McLeod, volunteered for Operation Ashtray 2. A few days later, it was decided at some high level that Jax was too knowledgeable an officer to risk capture a second time. Instead, I was selected to lead Ashtray 2, which would be a 2-team mission combining my RT California and RT New Hampshire, under Captain Fred Krupa. Although Krupa outranked me, I was a staff sergeant, he was fairly new, while already I had 14 months running recon and more than a dozen cross-border missions. Not once during our time together did Krupa try to pull rank. The other 6 Americans were our respective teammates, all NCOs. Rex Jacko, John Yancey, Richard Woody, Paul Kennicott, R. Michael Grace, and David Galasso. Additionally, we'd bring 4 Montagnards for a total of 12 men. Each day we planned, and each night we brainstormed in the NCO club. We studied past snatch attempts in which the prisoner was killed and concluded that merely having him dead to rights didn't assure success. You had to exploit that momentary edge and seize him so quickly he had no option but to submit. For the assault itself, our biggest man, John Yancey, would carry just a Browning 9mm pistol, so he'd have a hand free to grab the driver while Krupa covered him. Meanwhile, Richard Woody would clear the back and I'd dash around the truck's hood, eliminate the assistant driver, then help Yancey from inside if the driver put up a struggle. Once we tripped the ambush, our security teams 100 yards away on each flank would block the road. What if the driver was chained to the steering wheel, as agent reports alleged? Looking like a ninja mechanic, Yancey would carry 10-pound bolt cutters slung over his back. And if guards aboard the truck fired, we'd kneel and shoot upward to avoid crossfire and hope ricochets didn't get us. To be ready for any option, we rehearsed assaulting a truck traveling right or traveling left. But what happened after the snatch concerned us too. We had reports of an estimated battalion base camp just 500 yards from our ambush spot, and who knew what other NVA installations were nearby. We had to confuse and delay the enemy to buy time to get deep into the jungle with our slow-moving prisoner. So I developed what we dubbed goodie bags. Each man would carry a small canvas bag containing 5 time-delayed devices he would ignite and scatter during our withdrawal, leaving behind a virtual minefield of fragmentation, white phosphorus, and tear gas grenades that would cook off randomly for 45 minutes. Every time an NVA started into the jungle, it would seem, another device would explode, spewing dangerous fragments or white phosphorus amid a cloud of tear gas. and we'd set the truck afire with thermite and explosives, creating a beacon for airstrikes, while our big bonus, loitering in orbit just over the horizon, would be a Thailand-based AC-130 Spectre gunship, whose 20mm and 40mm guns would devastate Highway 1 as we withdrew. We rehearsed the ambush over and over. I was an unyielding taskmaster, but everyone understood, so there wasn't the slightest gripe. These weren't unwilling draftees, but seasoned Special Forces soldiers, most on their second tour in Vietnam, although several were new to recon. We walked through our first rehearsals, then a bit faster, finally at real time in daylight, then real time with live fire, then walked through it at night, real time at night, and for the final dress rehearsal, live fire at night. By then we could hit the truck, clear it, and seize the driver in less than 10 seconds. We were ready for the Super Bowl. When Krupa and I briefed the plan to Colonel Kavanaugh in Saigon, he sat back in his chair, thoughtfully silent for 30 seconds, then announced we must first conduct a short 2-day recon of the area we'd flee through after the ambush, to ensure we didn't rush into a hidden enemy base camp. Krupa led this quick mission, which slipped in and out without incident, while I finished last-minute preparations. 2 days later, our combined 12-man team inserted by helicopter. Except for a few signal shots and skirting an abandoned bunker area, our first 2 days were uneventful. The second night, about 10 p.m., I awoke and sat up, straining my ears. Yes, I heard trucks, about a mile away, 6, maybe 10 of them. In the shadows around me, I realized everyone else was sitting up too, listening but saying nothing. We all knew tomorrow was our night. Midway through the next day's slow, silent movement, we reached Highway 110. Krupa and I crept forward and found fresh truck tracks on the hard-packed single-lane road. 2 out of 3 recon missions never made it to such a heavily defended highway, and here we were within 2 yards, a very spooky feeling. This was a poor ambush site, a thin bamboo grove on the downhill side of the road, almost no cover or concealment, yet I was convinced that it was our best choice, betting that the enemy thought this so unlikely an ambush spot that they wouldn't sweep it or post guards along it at night. Late that afternoon, we radioed a code word to Leghorn, the SOG mountaintop radio relay station, which, as per our plan, would cause the Air Force to orbit an AC-130 Spectre gunship just over the horizon, 10 minutes away, ready to chew up the road with 20mm Vulcan cannons and 40mm AK-AK guns, when truckloads of NVA came rushing after us. At dusk, I gave each American a Green Hornet, a powerful SOG-issue amphetamine, which, like the old OSSB tablet, ensured 12 hours stamina, which I knew we'd need. It was still daylight when I made my next notebook entry. 1920, 7:20 p.m. One vehicle passed headed east to west, contained some troops and large wooden boxes. Beneath mounds of foliage lashed to the truck, Rex Jacko saw flat armored sides, probably a Soviet-made armored car carrying security troops. It sailed clean by. Then I wrote, 1925. Second truck passed, headed east to west. Believe it was empty. I actually saw the driver's smiling face while he downshifted. His truck was covered by bamboo lattice and piled high with leafy branches. With daylight almost gone, I signaled our flank security teams, led by Jacko on our left and Kennicott on the right, to advance to the road and emplace claymores. Next, our assault team crept up, Krupa, Woody, Yancey, and myself. With barely enough light to see, I laid out 3 claymores in a crescent, aimed at a prominent tree across the road. In the dark, I'd watch for the truck's front tire to align with that tree, then blow the mines. Typically for a SOG operation, we lay barely 15 feet from the nearest claymore, danger close. I made a final scribbled entry in my notebook, 1930, moved into location, will ambush the next truck regardless of contents or direction. Then we stayed face down beside the highway, and waited almost 2 hours. Had the enemy spotted us and canceled his convoys? Just before 21:30, the sound of a truck's engine grew gradually louder, until it seemed to roar like an approaching locomotive. A tire rolled directly before me, and kaboom! I blew the mines and shouted, "Assault!" Instantly, Yancey, Krupa, Woody, and I rushed the Soviet-made Gaz 63 truck that had lurched to a halt in front of us. Flash blinded in one eye from watching the detonation, I'd just have to shoot left-eyed. I dashed around the hood, ready to kill the assistant driver. There was none. Then covered as Yancey jerked the driver like a rag doll out the opposite door, threw him to the ground and pinned him while Krupa slid plastic restraints on the stunned man's wrists. The driver sobbed in broken English, "No kill! No kill!" Yancey gladly threw away his bolt cutters. I'll never forget the amazing vision of Fred Krupa with his Kodak Instamatic and flash cubes, standing in the middle of the notorious Highway 110, flashing away as I tossed a satchel charge in the truck and placed a time-delay thermite grenade on its hood. Seconds later I shouted, "Withdraw! Withdraw!" which Woody backed up with two whistle blasts, as rehearsed. Then a hidden enemy soldier shot Woody bad, through both arms. Jacko took hold of Woody and led him backward toward the rally point. Krupa and Yancey dragged away the prisoner. That left only me at the truck. I had to buy time for the rest to get a head start, so I began exchanging fire with several enemy soldiers. Meanwhile, our flak security men were igniting time fuses for the 40 assorted grenades that would go off over the next 45 minutes to hit other trucks, as well as to confuse and delay the many North Vietnamese soldiers converging on the ambush site. At the rally point, Galasso, a special forces medic, patched Woody up as best he could. Despite great pain, both his forearms had been shattered by AK slugs, Woody refused morphine for fear it would slow us down. He was one tough trooper. As I backed away, I could hear NVA shouting and shooting from the road, taking cover behind the ambush truck. Then the 5-pound satchel charge went off, killing the lot of them. It was time to call in the Spectre and show these guys what firepower was. Krupa radioed our mountaintop radio relay site, only to learn the Spectre was not on station. No explanation was offered, and we had no time to ask. With more NVA at the road and shouting and 4 signal shots in the distance, we had to get out of there. While we were running for our lives, back at FOB 2 in Kon Tum, the staff vacillated. Lieutenant Colonel Apt had rotated back to the States that very morning, leaving an officer of questionable competence in charge who thought it just fine to wait until morning to do something. But Sergeant First Class Lloyd O.D. O'Daniels, already angered to learn no Spectre had arrived, snapped, "Bullshit! Let's get a helicopter to take us up to Play Coup and go out there tonight with a Covey FAC aircraft." It was midnight when O'Daniels flew across the border, but he had no trouble finding us. He could see the beacon of burning trucks from 10 miles away. Here we were, in deep trouble. But true to his light-hearted nature, O.D. radioed the badly wounded Woody, whom he owed money from an R&R. "Woody," he said, "I told you I was going to screw you out of that $150 one way or the other." While we ran through that pitch-black jungle, O.D. used the flames of burning trucks to direct pair after pair of U.S. fighters, continuously bombing the ambush site, the road, and our back trail until just before dawn. We paused only twice all night to treat Woody or check the prisoner's restraints. Our air assets launched in darkness to arrive overhead at the very crack of dawn. Hueys from the 57th Gladiators Assault Helicopter Company, escorted by Cobra gunships from the 361st Pink Panthers Attack Helicopter Company. Just before the Hueys came in, a pair of A-1 Sky Raiders made one last pass, dispensing cluster bombs. And as O'Daniels reported, they dropped it right on top of you. And I thought, oh shit, I've wiped them all out. But God was with us that morning, for although cluster bombs exploded in all directions, as close as 5 yards, not a man was hit. Then the Hueys swooped in and we were gone. We'd made it out, driver intact, Woody seriously wounded, and myself with minor shrapnel wounds. After our tumultuous welcome on the Khon-Thum helipad, we barely had time to drop off our gear in the RT California team room when the recon first sergeant told me a SOG Blackbird would arrive in 10 minutes to transport the prisoner and me to Saigon. Sure enough, 10 minutes later, I was leading the blindfolded and handcuffed NVA into a C-130. We were the only passengers. Because this was all improvised, the Blackbird dropped us at Saigon's Thanh Son Nhut civilian terminal instead of the out-of-the-way Air America ramp. Unshaven, with traces of camouflage stick smeared across my face, I led the handcuffed but no longer blindfolded prisoner across the tarmac. Once he saw the amazing reality of a modern bustling airport, he became a bit antsy. To reestablish perspective, I put the muzzle of my .45 automatic to his head and held it there as we walked the 100 yards to the military terminal. He calmed right down. But the rear echelon types at the terminal took one glance at the scene, a haggard me approaching with a .45 pressed to a bound captive, and suddenly remembered they had to go someplace else. In 10 minutes, an unmarked SOG commercial van arrived to take us away. Mission done, I began to thirst mightily for a cold beer. Then I learned SOG's deputy chief, USAF Colonel Ross Franklin, and I had an important appointment. General Abrams wanted to see us. After a shower and haircut for me, Colonel Franklin and I traveled to MACV headquarters, where we were ushered into a small amphitheater. I've never since seen such a gathering. Around that horseshoe table sat 7, 2, 3, and 4-star generals, and in the middle, chewing a cigar in his high, leather ship captain's chair, was General Abrams himself. For 10 minutes I recounted the operation, step by step, and I recall when I described how the cluster of NVA shooting from behind the truck were snuffed when it blew up. There was a chuckle around the room. When I finished, Abrams shook my hand and asked that I pass his congratulations to all the ASHTRAE 2 ambushers, and he meant it. Abrams' kind words surprised me, for he had a reputation for being rabidly anti-special forces. Later, Colonel Kavanaugh explained, "Despite his biases, Abrams was a fighting man and respected courage under fire, no matter where he found it." An hour after briefing General Abrams, I was in an air-conditioned nightclub, trading toasts with friends from SOG headquarters. My only regret was not celebrating with my ambusher comrades that night. Looking over Saigon's lights from that rooftop bar, I lifted my glass in a toast to them all. Ours was just one of 3 prisoners SOG brought out of Laos that year, and the only enemy soldier specifically targeted, then successfully captured in SOG's history. Chief SOG Colonel Kavanaugh later called ASHTRAE 2 undoubtedly our most successful operation, where we had visualized doing something, planned it, then had it done. A few months after ASHTRAE 2, a SOG platoon operating near Highway 110 snatched a wounded NVA soldier who reported truck drivers still feared darkness and the American night commandos who might kill them. Or worse yet, steal them away, never to be seen again. Severely wounded, Richard Woody was stabilized, then medevaced back to the U.S. He fully recovered. Although Paul Kennicott came through our ambush unscathed, he was badly wounded almost a year later while reconning 5 miles from where we hit that night convoy. He too was medevaced. John Yancey, who dragged the driver from the truck, later received the Distinguished Service Cross for single-handedly defending a badly wounded comrade, David Baby Huey Hayes, against NVA attackers for more than an hour until a rescue force arrived. I thought he deserved the Medal of Honor. One of Delta Force's earliest counter-terrorists, John landed at Desert One in Iran in 1980 during the failed hostage rescue attempt. Later, due to another Delta Force trooper's error, John was killed in a live-fire training exercise. He is still missed. Just over a year after ASHTRAE 2, Fred Krupa was leading a company-sized SOG raid on the Cambodian border when he fell from a hovering helicopter after being hit by an AK round. I was directly overhead, flying Covey. Although we put in many airstrikes and tried to launch a rescue mission, We never got Fred back. He remains missing in action. God bless him. 10. Bloody 68. By early 1968, K-San, where the U.S. presence had begun as a simple A-camp and SOG's FOB, had become the western anchor of DMZ defenses, held by the 6,000-strong 26th Marine Regiment. Surrounding them were 20,000 NVA, pounded day and night by U.S. artillery fighters and B-52s. SOG's presence at Khe Sanh and the role played by its cross-border missions from there went publicly undisclosed. Inside the base perimeter, SOG's 50 U.S. and 500 indigenous personnel were dug in, just like the Marines, withstanding up to 1,500 rounds of incoming artillery and rockets per day. Outside Khe Sanh, in those incredibly dangerous hills, prowled recon men from SOG's FOB 1 at Phu Bai, who uncovered targets for airstrikes, wiretapped phone lines, and emplaced sensors. To bypass the monsoon squalls that closed the Laotian border west of Khe Sanh as solidly as a wall, some teams launched from SOG's top-secret back door, Nakhon Phanom, NKP Air Base in Thailand, 145 miles away, completely across Laos. 7 SOG Americans operated the NKP launch site, working with the USAF 21st Pony Special Operations Squadron, sister unit to SOG's 20th SOS Green Hornets. Since January 1967, the Ponies had supported SOG agent teams in North Vietnam and CIA operations in northern Laos, and then, late that year, began inserting American-led SOG teams in Laos. The Thai launch operation proved important in early 1968, when SOG helicopters could not operate from the besieged Khe Sanh airfield. One continuing SOG target was Koh Rock, the dominant terrain feature west of Khe Sanh, a 3-mile-wide bluff whose 1,800-foot limestone cliffs signaled each dawn with a rosy glow 10 minutes before sunrise. Just a half-mile into Laos and safe from Marine ground attack, Koh Rock was honeycombed with caves and tunnels sheltering enemy artillery pieces. Recalled one recon man who penetrated Koh Rock, Rick Bayer. They had steps cut in the mountain you could walk down. They had bamboo poles with candles where they could march their troops up. They had trails coming off the main trails all over that mountain. On 12 January 1968, RT Indiana was ambushed on Koh Rock's reversed side. The team broke contact and evaded through a deep gully, but somehow, the 1-1, Staff Sergeant Jim Coron and 2 Nongs became separated from the others. Coron's teammates made it to a small knoll where they vainly tried to race him by radio. They barely made it out themselves. Coron disappeared. Eventually, U.S. intelligence concluded RT Indiana had been hit by the NVA Dong Nai Regiment, which signal intercepts disclosed had interrogated an American determined to be Coron. To this day, Hanoi denies any knowledge of the Iowa-born Green Beret. 5 miles west of Khe Sanh, in the shadow of Koh Rock on the Laotian border, lay South Vietnam's most distant from Saigon outpost, Long Ve Special Forces Camp, commanded by Captain Frank Willoughby. As NVA strength grew in early 1968, the camp's 282 Montagnards were reinforced with another yard company and additional Green Berets. RT Indiana walked into Long Ve one night in late January after being chased several days near Koh Rock. 1-1 Rick Beyer sought out Long Ve's team sergeant Bill Craig with a special warning. RT Indiana had seen tank tracks. Furthermore, when they waded across the nearby Sekong River at dusk, they found the NVA had surveyed the river and marked off suitable fording sites. Bayer had no doubt the NVA were going to bring tanks into South Vietnam. "When we got flown down to Saigon for debriefing," Bayer recalls disgustedly, "I was called the liar." Also disgusted was his Phu Bai FOB 1 commander, Major Ed Ribot. "We'd send the reports in and they'd say, 'No, you're wrong. These are earth-building tractors or bulldozers.' Now, I'm an old tanker. And I know a damned tank track, and those were PT-76s. In Saigon, Chief SOG Colonel Jack Singlob was convinced the NVA was staging tanks for a strike. MACV ignored his warnings. Just after midnight of 6 February, Marines in Khe San's western trenches heard a mechanical groaning in the wind like a chainsaw revving. Tanks. At Long Vey, the ground shook as 11 PT-76 tanks and an NVA infantry battalion supported by 152mm howitzers stormed into the tiny camp. Flamethrowers flashed while the tanks' 76mm guns shattered bunker after bunker. More than half the camp's Montagnard defenders died in their positions, emptying M1 carbines and machine guns at the oncoming tanks. The Green Berets managed to destroy more than half the PT-76s with 106mm recoilless rifles, but hastily supplied M72 Law anti-tank rockets failed miserably. Captain Willoughby and a handful of holdouts locked themselves in the camp's command bunker, while a PT-76 climbed atop it, spinning one track to try to dig them out like a badger tearing at a gopher hole. Chief SOG relayed words of the attack to MACV, and the J2 flat-out refused to believe it. He just said, "There are no tanks in Vietnam." When a SOG delegation at Khe San forwarded Long Vey's request for a relief force, Colonel David Lowndes, the 26th Marines commander, refused the request and said that he would not sacrifice any American lives, recalled recon man Harvey Saul. "He just glared through us like an ex-"